This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Boston Mayor-elect Marty Walsh savored victory today. Last night, voters elected him to become the city's 48th mayor, and this afternoon, he said he's still getting used to his new title.
It didn't really hit me till this morning. I was the mayor-elect of the city of Boston when I was getting dressed, and I walked out, and I looked at Laurie, and she goes, "Oh, my God, you're going to be the mayor."
Walsh rallied a broad coalition across the city of liberals, minorities, and union members, edging out City Councilor John Connolly by less than 5,000 votes, 52-48%. Today, Walsh held his first press conference as mayor-elect. Meghna, you were there. Tell us where he was and what his mood was like.
Well, the press conference was right at the top of Boston Common, across the street from the State House, which makes sense when you remember that Marty Walsh is still a sitting state rep, and there was a House formal session that he had to get to this afternoon. Beautiful day here in Boston. Very autumnal gold leaves fluttering about as he was speaking to the media pack assembled around him. But, you know, we heard that little self-deprecating quip he made about his wife saying, "Oh, my God, you're going to be mayor." And I get the sense that, you know, maybe that's true, that it really hasn't fully sunk in yet to Marty Walsh. Because, you know, he talked about, interestingly, all the calls that he received last night from, you know, people in Washington, including President Obama, Bill Clinton, and a couple of others. He seemed kind of wowed by all of it. Here's another call and how Walsh described it.
And also, I got a call from Vice President Biden that I missed, and he's on my voicemail. And he just congratulated me as well, saying it's great to see a kid from the neighborhood be elected mayor of the city of Boston.
And Anthony, I should also note that Mayor-elect Marty Walsh also did mention the call he received from his former opponent, John Connolly.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that because in general, this race was pretty positive, mostly positive, except toward the end when it grew tense between the two of them. They argued over attacks from outside groups, push polling. What did he say about that and in general how he's feeling about John Connolly?
Well, he reiterated much of what he said last night at his victory party, that John Connolly is and has been his friend. And that Connolly is really the one who brought education to the forefront of the election as a major issue. And Walsh also said that he looks forward to talking with John Connolly more about that. But he did say that he hadn't talked to Connolly at all about joining his administration, you know, come January, and wasn't even sure if Connolly would want to do that. And interestingly, while we're talking about the future Walsh administration, he did say the same thing about Charlotte Golar Richie, John Barros, and Felix Arroyo, those three really key endorsements that he got during the race. That Walsh hadn't spoken to any of them yet about joining his administration.
Now, Walsh also met with Mayor Tom Menino this morning at City Hall. Menino said there's a transition office set up for Walsh and a transition budget of $50,000. Menino did not endorse either candidate in the race, but this morning he had this to say about Marty Walsh.
I have a lot of confidence in this young man. We go back a few years. We had some conversations this past year that when I was sick, Marty came to visit me and we talked about the future.
It was an interesting moment because, Anthony, as you know, talking about the future in the case of the city of Boston means we have to acknowledge the past. And Marty Walsh did that for the fact that Tom Menino has been in office for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so this afternoon at the press conference, Walsh said he had asked for Mayor Menino's advice, and this is what he was told.
He just basically said, you know, a lot of people are going to be coming at you. You have a lot of friends now. He said, just, you know, be careful and move forward. And he said, stay connected to the residents of the city of Boston.
You know, I'm recalling that when Marty Walsh came in here a couple of months ago when he first launched his race, he said this is the job he's wanted since he was 8 years
old.
So now he's got it. So what struck you most about today's press conference, Meghna?
You know, what was most interesting to me, Anthony, is what actually happened away from the microphone. Because just, you know, twice in this conversation, we've already spoken about how the neighborhoods have come up. Tom Menino saying, stay connected to the neighborhoods. Joe Biden calling and leaving a message saying he's glad a kid from the neighborhoods got elected. And that deep feeling was really evident as now Mayor-elect Marty Walsh walked from the top of Boston Common across the street and into the State House, because as he was doing that, a lot of people stopped him to congratulate him, give him hugs. Some Boston police officers did, gave him supportive embraces. And even one guy I saw said, you know, he stopped him, gave him a big bear hug, whispered into Marty Walsh's ear, "You're still going to be my neighbor, right?" So that connection really did seem there to be there, and Walsh said, "You bet."
You bet. Well, a start of a new era in Boston coming soon. And joining us to further dissect last night's results and what may lie ahead for Boston's new mayor are WBUR's political reporter David Scharfenberg. Hey, David.
Hello there.
And Democratic political analyst Susan Tracy. She's a former state rep and now president of the Strategy Group. group and a frequent guest on our show. Hi, Susan. Good to have
you back. Hey, Anthony. How are you? Hey, David.
Hi there.
So let's talk about this vote. It was close. And David, I want to ask you about the map because it sort of split right along the kind of ridge of this east-west ridge in this city with a sort of western side going to John Connolly, the eastern side going to Marty Walsh. What did you take away from that map?
Yeah, it is a pretty dramatic map up on our WBUR website. We'll give it a little plug there. But yeah, you really see kind of blue on one side and red on the other. Both these guys are Democrats, of course. And it really did reinforce the divisions in this city, I think. Meghna and I were talking about this earlier with Mayor Menino in office. It was easy to kind of paper over some of that. But with a new election, first major race, most competitive race in a generation, you did see some divides in this city. That western edge of the city is a bit more affluent, a bit more educated. They clearly saw in John Connolly a man of the new Boston, someone who was in touch with the changes in this city. And that eastern part of the city is a bit more blue-collar, economically, even culturally. I mean, places like South Boston are certainly gentrifying, but they've still really rooted in the old ways of Boston. And importantly, Marty Walsh racked up some big victories in the center of the city in black and Latino neighborhoods that really seemed to grasp his blue-collar message. And, of course, there were some important endorsements that we'll probably talk about as well that played into that.
Yeah, and Susan, let me ask you about those endorsements because, again, looking at that map, in those communities of color, Mattapan, Roxbury, parts of Dorchester, Marty Walsh really did really well against John Connolly. So that brings to mind, I know the question has come up a lot, but those endorsements seem to be so important from Felix Arroyo, Charlotte Golar Richard, and John Barros. That's sort of when the momentum seemed to turn in his favor.
One, your map is terrific, so I do want to say that, and I completely agree with you. Those endorsements and the way they rolled out and came, those were the three significant minority candidates running in the preliminary election, and to have all of them go with Marty Walsh, you clearly see it. I completely agree with you, David. If you look at that map and you look at those wards that are central, that are the minority wards, the 14s, the 15s, the other significant piece here, I think, though, in addition to that minority piece, is Ward 18, which is in Hyde Park, which borders Ward 20, which is West Roxbury, which is where John is from. Ward 18, there are 23 precincts, and every one of them was won by Marty Walsh. And to me, the race was really won when Marty put together that coalition with the minority community and won Ward 18 so strongly.
Quick follow-up, Susan, because the conventional wisdom, and we said this on our air, is that endorsements don't win votes. But in this case, it seemed like they did. Was it just because he kind of ran the table on these with these endorsements, or what's your view on that?
Well, it's not so much that the endorsements become votes, but those were the three significant minority candidates, one of whom is a colleague of John's in the city council, Felix Arroyo. And the fact that all three of them said, after spending months campaigning and going to events and being in forums together, that at the end of that they said, we're with Marty Walsh, I think was a tough blow for John Connolly. And I think if you're outside and you don't know a lot, that's a real validation of Marty Walsh and Marty Walsh and the minority community in particular.
Mm. Now, before we move on, I just have to make a slight correction of something I said a little earlier. I called Lori Marty Walsh's wife. And that was a mistake. She is a longtime partner of his. So my apologies for that mistake, but correction duly noted. We're talking about the great map that that David and the WBR team have put online that shows how the votes fell from neighborhood to neighborhood. But we also have to acknowledge that this was a close race, fewer than 5,000 total votes between the two candidates. So question for both of you, and let me start with you, David. Because the vote was so close, how do you think or what are you hearing from people about how Marty Walsh fully brings the city together?
Well, he did have his skeptics here. He did have nearly half the city voting against him. I think some of the chief concerns were his ties to labor, which we've heard quite a bit about. He's a longtime labor leader, of course. Some concerns about whether he will negotiate solid contracts with city employees. So he's going to have to allay those fears quickly, I think, in order to win over some of his skeptics. I think he was also more focused on biography, on kind of the nuts and bolts of running the city. John Connolly was more the vision candidate, if you will, here. So I think if he can set out out some sort of unifying vision for the city, I think that will go a long way as well.
Susan, if you were Marty Walsh, what would you do on the, you know, come January to really to knit the disparate parts of the city together?
Well, I wouldn't wait till January. It's probably the first thing I'd do. I think he's got to sit down with John Conley right away. He's got to reach out to the Conley supporters. He probably has to bring some folks from the Conley camp into his camp. He probably is going to have to bring some people into City Hall who might have been with John Conley. And the one thing I would say, and I think you touched on this earlier, is this was, in general, a very positive campaign. So unlike some campaigns where there is a bitter divide at the end where it's hard to imagine the two sides sitting together, I think you heard from both of them last night. They consider each other friends, and I think they did a really good job of making uniting this city after this race not as hard as it could have been.
Mm. So he can lay a lot of groundwork before the actual transition in January.
He has to.
But David, you know, he's got to fill a lot of city posts, major city posts, in his new administration. You know, what are they in particular, and they're important ones? What kind of scrutiny do you think he's going to get?
Quite a bit. These would be very important personnel decisions. He's got to name a new superintendent of schools. Our WBUR poll in the run-up to this election showed that education is the number one concern in the city. His opponent, John Connolly, was hyper-focused on education, so there will be some scrutiny of Marty Walsh and how he approaches education. He'll also have to name a new police commissioner. There was a lot of talk in this campaign about the need for greater diversity in the police force. He sort of hinted that he might name a person of color to that post. His minority supporters will certainly be holding him to account on the question of leadership in the city and, I think, in the police department in particular.
Let's move on, because yesterday's election also dealt a stinging rebuke to the gambling industry. Voters in East Boston said no to a casino at Suffolk Downs, despite an expensive pro-casino push there. And in Western Massachusetts, voters in Palmer rejected a billion-dollar casino plan from the Mohegan Indian tribe. Joining us now is John Ribeiro. He's chairman of the group Repeal the Casino Deal. And John, welcome to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So what was your vote, your reaction to last night's vote? What explained the opposition that we saw, particularly in East Boston?
Well, we're very excited about the vote, obviously. As one of our folks put it, we believed we could do it, but I don't think we ever dared to imagine that it could actually happen with all the resources and political clout mounted on the other side. We knew it was an uphill battle all the way. And
so what did it? What was out there that made you guys successful? Because as you said, you were outspent by forces that that had a whole lot more to spend than you did.
Yeah. So we had people on the ground that were really concerned about their community and their way of life. And when you have that, you have passion, and that's what's infectious, and that's what spread to the rest of the neighborhood. When people realized what was going to come along with this casino, all the impacts that were going to happen with it, then they realized that they needed to get out there and make a difference and make their voices heard, despite whether they liked the people, other folks who also shared the ballot with this question.
So where do we go? What's your view about where this goes now? East Boston rejected the casino, but Revere voted to support it. So is an all-Revere plan possible? That is, just pulling the casino into Revere and out of East Boston. Is that going to do it?
Well, I suppose it's possible, but under the current law and the current gaming regulations, it's actually impossible. The measure that was on the ballot yesterday called for a casino that was going to be run by Caesars. That was actually on the ballot. We know that they are out. Now East Boston is out of the picture. So I don't see how they just pick up that model and move it into Revere and call it a done deal. They need to go back before the Gaming Commission, come up with a new proposal, have a new host community agreement with Revere, and have a vote, all by December 31st. Now, for the past 2 years, they've been telling us that Caesars is the world-class organization, and we found out just a couple weeks ago that that's not true. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how we're going to get to the point where we have a new proposal that's approved by the voters in time for the deadline.
And finally, John, talk a little bit about what happened in Western Massachusetts. Close vote there in Palmer against the Mohegan Sun plan. My understanding is they're requesting a recount out there. But do you think this anti-casino momentum, it seems to be spreading across the state here?
Yeah, I would argue that this is just a continuation of the anti-casino momentum. We've only seen a few of these votes actually come to a referendum. You can go back to Foxborough a couple of years ago, Tewksbury, Danvers, West Springfield earlier this year. And in Holyoke, their mayor, a casino mayor, was reelected to a second term over a pro-casino mayor just last night. So Palmer and East Boston are just another on the list of communities that have rejected casino proposals. And what this really shows is that when you have the opportunity to make the case on both sides, we may not have resources, but we have the truth and we have the evidence of what happens in other communities and states when they bring a casino in. And once people can actually get that message and evaluate it on their own, they're going to reject casinos. So what we're working towards right now, we have a measure out that we're going to try to put before the voters of Massachusetts next year. We're collecting signatures to repeal the casino law altogether, so that we don't have to deal with this at all anymore. Not in my backyard, not in your backyard, not in anyone's backyard.
All right. That's John Ribeiro. He's chairman of the group Repeal the Casino Deal. John, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Anthony.
Susan Tracy, you're our Democratic consultant and also president of the strategy group. I want to ask you a question about this the casino vote, but beforehand, just for transparency's sake, I should also say that you have previously consulted with Suffolk Downs. But I'm curious what you think, Susan, about where the vote puts, to tie this back to Mayor-elect Marty Walsh, where this puts him, because he has for a long time said, you know, he would, of course, honor however East Boston decided to vote. But at the same time, we know that he, you know, he's for all the jobs that this, you know, $1 billion casino project would bring to the Boston area.
Yeah, it was an interesting vote, I thought, last night, because Marty Walsh won in East Boston, and he clearly had stated his support for the casino. And there was an anti-casino city council candidate running last night who lost to the incumbent city council candidate. So a little bit of mixed message, a little bit, but I guess I would assume that a mayor who has East Boston as among the neighborhoods of Boston, if the East Boston community is not supportive of something, I'd be hard-pressed to think that the mayor would go against the wishes of the community.
Your thoughts, David?
I think that's right. I mean, he did say ad nauseum that he would respect the wishes of the people of East Boston. I think voters really did separate these two issues in their mind. They were really pretty passionate about the casino and its possible impacts on the neighborhood, but they were clearly able to separate that from their views on the mayoral race.
That's David Scharfenberg. He's WBUR's political reporter. And Susan Tracy, Democratic political analyst, former state rep, and the president of the strategy group. Thank you both, Susan and David.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you.
See you, Magna.
Well, it is a new day in Boston politics, but let's look back at a major political event that happened more than 50 years ago.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor.
To mark the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, WBUR is listening back to the speeches of the president in a new series, November 1963.
Today, we return to January 20th, 1961, and the inaugural address from a president elected by the narrowest margin since 1916. WBUR's Kelly Horan takes us back.
Under a blazing January sky, the president stands in another glare as well, the skeptical gaze of the nearly 50% of the electorate who hadn't voted for him. He begins with a clarion call intended to appeal to all Americans.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace.
Kennedy's inaugural address is one part Cold War speech, one part domestic agenda.
So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. Let both sides explore what problems unite us instead of belaboring those problems which divide us. Let both sides, for the first time, formulate serious and precise proposals for the inspection and control of arms, and bring the absolute power to destroy other nations under the absolute control of all nations. Let both sides seek to invoke the wonders of science instead of its terrors. Together, let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depth, and encourage the arts and commerce.
By all accounts, Kennedy galvanizes his audience, but he tempers their expectations as well.
All this will not be finished in the first 100 days, nor will it be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even perhaps in our lifetime on this planet. But let us begin.
Kennedy reportedly told his speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, that he wanted this inaugural speech to be as enduring as Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. As he draws to a close, he makes a spontaneous change to the text, assuring that that will be the case.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Excerpts from President John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, delivered on January 20th, 1961. Our story was produced by WBUR's Kelly Horan with help from WBUR's George Hicks as part of our series November 1963.
And tune in to Morning Edition this coming Friday as we look at President Kennedy's unfinished agenda on civil rights. And stay with us up next with college tuition going up, up, and up around the country. Leslie University in Cambridge moves to cut its tuition rate by 25%. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.